And I'm Jackie. Welcome, everyone. Virginio Gigli. Well, I have been going through basically a weird combination of not playing for a series of days or even weeks, and then having intense, usually weekends, in which I get to play. Mostly because I've been transitioning to the new job, which took some adjusting in terms of time. But I have played a few things that I hadn't played in a while. One of which is obviously First Rat, which I hadn't played at all, that we will speak about later. But I got to play Gaia Project, which is the new version, well, new, not that new at this point, but is the reimagining of Terra Mystica, which is a game that I hadn't played in probably 10 years or so. So it was one of the first few games that I reviewed, and I remember at the time not liking it particularly. I played it, I finished the game, it wasn't horrendous, but it felt really dry despite all of the things that it comes with. So for those who haven't played it, it's very hard to summarize, but it's very much a Euro. You are building stuff on a map, trying to build adjacent to other people to get discounts, but you also get advantages to them when you build them. You are managing this basically series of building. The buildings replace other building, and while you build better ones, you get advantages both one time and throughout the game. You are managing power, which is magic in the old version and technological power in Gaia Project, where you there is a weird cycling thing where you accumulate basically special points that you can spend to get extra actions. You are managing tracks on which you're moving up for points. And the gist of the game is that everyone is playing a different species in Gaia Project or a fantasy race in Terra Mystica that gives you a certain condition, basically how expensive it is to build on certain terrains on the map, and gives you a special power that is completely unique and feels is one of those things that feels broken to everyone else while yours feels absolutely normal. And I must say, I played Gaia Project. We met with an Italian guy who lives in Ireland, lives in Cork, Alessandro. And we hadn't ever played together, but we had met at the convention. So he invited us over because another friend from Dublin was coming down. And so he had already pre-selected and prepared the game. So we got into it. And I must say, I probably would have not chosen it. And I'm not looking forward to play Gaia Project again, but I like it way more than I remember liking Terra Mystica. I think one of the main differences is that now the tracks, which were very much try to get up and get points in Terra Mystica, are now tech trees that are very significant, do a lot of different things, and open up what you can do. So not only they let you customize your game, but also they make you feel like you can do more. It's still a clunky game. There is a lot that seems to be there just to be complex rather than to be exciting and could have been streamlined a little bit, but I did like it. Did you play Gaia Project? So I don't see why someone should play Terra Mystica at this point. I mean, I guess maybe if someone is really into it and if they find it more balanced or anything like that, but to try just to see how it is, I would very much suggest trying Gaia Project. I think you could like it even more than me because you tend to have a higher tolerance for a little more involved, a little longer Euros. It's not on a Lacerta level, meaning that the mechanisms are euro complex, but they are not all interconnected. So you can focus on one thing or another rather than having to worry about everything at the same time. It's nice. It's one thing that I can say that is very positive is that it's extremely interactive, both because the spatial element, where do you want to build, you are competing for territories. Second, because again, you get discounts to build near people, but you also give them some of this power that you can spend. And third, because at the end of each round, you are selecting, when you pass, you select your bonus for the next round. So there is a timing factor of either I want to pass before you so I can be ahead of you in turn order and get what you might want, or vice versa, I want to pass after you because when you pass, you have to relinquish the power that you have currently. You cannot choose the same. And so maybe I want to pass after you. So there is a lot of points of interaction, which are, it's good for a game like this that otherwise could feel a little bit solitarish if it wasn't for that. Which is what I have heard of it. So mentioning that I haven't played it, I haven't even seen it on the board, I would be surprised if it had a great success. Because I think that people who like Terra Mystica, who got into Gaia Project, or even they just tried Gaia Project, they are not looking for a smaller experience, right? This is not, for all that I like shorter Euros, this never felt, another very good thing was, we played for 3.5 hours or something like that, and we finished at 2 in the morning. But it never felt slow. I still think there were a little too many things that I was worrying about. I would have liked to play some parts of the game. For example, the power, which is so distinctive. You're basically moving tokens from section 1 to section 2 to section 3. And when they are in section 3, you can spend them by moving them back to section 1, something like that. And there are different ways to get movements of these single tokens up these rondel, basically. I think it's clunky, but the game itself felt like there wasn't something that was simply added on, tacked on, right? And so I would be very curious to see who likes Terra Nova, because for people who like more streamlined Euros like I usually do, then there are other offers. Yeah, if someone likes Terra Mystica or Gaia Project, switching to something that is smaller would probably feel limiting, I imagine. But I see it as a decent rating on BGG, so I might be wrong. Although significantly lower than Terra Mystica. Terra Mystica has an 8.1 average rating, while 7.4 is Terra Nova, despite probably a certain amount of selection bias, right? Despite the fact that probably most people who played Terra Nova had played Terra Mystica before, so they were that kind of gamers. So I think that's volume. Have you played something stimulating? Yes. I am trying to think of when did we record last time, but in case, did I talk about Game of Thrones, The Iron Throne? I don't think so. So I'll be short so that if I have already spoken about it, I will simply cut it in the edit. So a long time ago, I tried Game of Thrones, the board game, which is a very popular game, very long, definitely not a Euro, very interaction-based. It's secret orders on the board and very negotiation-heavy. And I had great expectation. At the time, I don't think the TV show was out for Game of Thrones, but I was really into the books. So I was very excited. All of my friends were very excited about it. We got it. They got it for me for Christmas or for a birthday, something like that. And we played it and I hated it with a passion. The problem with the game, or at least the problem for me, is two things. First, I don't mind negotiation games, but it's a game that doesn't present necessarily itself as a negotiation game. Is not as pure as other negotiation stuff. And so it becomes a lot of, some players are playing it as a negotiation game, some others are not, and they can get quite frustrated. And that's one thing. The second thing is, the first edition that was sold in the second edition had some very unbalanced house decks, but that got sold. But the third thing that stayed true in the second edition and that I stayed away from the game for is that is this game very low luck. Battles are resolved by you need to have more units than the opponent, plus these cards that are deterministic because you choose, you don't randomly draw, you have all of your decks, so you know what other people can play and all of that. As one random element, which is the turn events. And among these events, there are recruiting events, which are basically giving you troops or giving you supplies based on how many of certain territories you control. So you could control, I don't know, six territories and no card comes out. Then you control six territories and no card comes out. Then I take two of your territories and all of a sudden the reinforcement card comes out. So I get the reward for holding the six territories for one turn while you didn't get it for three. And that to me was a big no-no because it's a big long game. And so having it pivot on that. So, but I stay with this passion for the theme because despite the infamous last season, it's still a theme and a setting that I really like. And I found the right game for me in the Game of Thrones universe after saying for years that The Hand of the King was my favorite Game of Thrones game in The Iron Throne. The Iron Throne is a re-edition or re-implementation of Cosmic Encounter, another game that I didn't like. Cosmic Encounter is... that is very transparently a negotiation game. You're trying to get to 5 points. Each turn, when it's your turn, sorry, you flip a card that tells you who you are going to attack. In Cosmic Encounter, you have ships and those like interstellar spaceships. And you are using those. Basically, they are your armies. That's your strength. The defender has their strength. And then you ask people around the table, do you want to join the attacker? Do you want to join the defender? You can negotiate what you're getting for what. And then you play a card, the defender plays a card, you add all of the strength of yourself and your allies, the defender adds the strength of themselves and their allies to the card, whoever has the highest card, the highest total wins. The problem I had with Cosmic Encounter was dual. First, intentionally, the powers were of the different characters were supposed to be completely wacky, completely game-breaking, out of balance, very weird, and they added more and more. But that's also part of the charm. But what really, really didn't make it for me is that in this giant deck that we were all drawing from, there were cards from 1 to 40. So I could manage to be stronger than you, get two allies, get to a strength of 21 against your strength of 7, and then I play a 5, you play a 30, and I lose. And then we draw replacement cards, and you can play, draw another 40, and I draw another 2, right? While in this new version, first, they clean the powers a little bit. Second, they are tied to what the characters are doing. So, for example, Lannister can use basically resources to win battles. Stark cannot be cheated very easily. It's a little more thematic, but most importantly, each player has their own deck, which is the same for all players, goes from 1 to 10, and then you have a 12 and a 20. So yes, you can use your 20, but A, I know exactly that 20 is your higher limit. And B, if you use your 20, you need to have it in hand. And at that point, it's gone. You won't play the 20 again. So there is this balance and this simple change of rules is not much compared to the totality of the game, but makes it into a very, very fun game for me. It plays in about an hour with 5 players. With the expansion, it can go to 7. everyone is involved in each turn because it's very rare for someone to be left out from both sides. Technically, it's possible. Like if you are 1 point away from winning, it might be that people just want you out. It's one of those games where you need to play with the right spirit. You need to understand or interiorize that winning is better than losing, but winning alone is better than winning with someone else. Because otherwise, it could be simply a matter of every turn, get as many people as you can. Everyone gets a point. You quickly get with three or four people at 5 points and one person loses. That wouldn't be great. But if you're trying to, I'll try to be ahead, but wait, I'd rather win with Nathan than lose alone. And it's really interesting. I think it works very well. Yeah. And I think the cheater is an extreme outlier, but that kind of, I don't know really what can happen. It's too extreme for me in a game like that, even taking away the extremes. And part of it is also in Game of Thrones. But first, with the fact that there are relatively fewer possibilities, it's a little easier for them to balance the power against each other. Second, they made very clear timing. Like there are some powers that can be activated before we declare alliances, some powers that can be activated before we play cards, some powers that can be played after we reveal cards, and some powers after resolution. So very clean. So while there is a lot of stuff that can go on, and also it's not completely up for grab. You have 5 characters in your army, in your faction. You choose one as your leader, and that power is an ongoing power. And then you have the four characters that are basically your commanders that can die. They have each their own strength, whatever. But you need to have that card for that character and play it so that once you use, I don't know, Jaime Lannister once, I know that your power with Jaime Lannister is this specific power and that you will always be able to activate it if you're using Jaime Lannister. So it shrinks the realm of possibility of things that can be done, not in absolute terms. You can get different things in different turns, but there is a little more control. It's not continuously a, oh, surprise, the rule doesn't apply, right? The rules can be subverted, but in a way that is not completely public information, but is a little more controllable. And I really like that because it has significant amount of chaos because you're constantly changing alliances. Oh, you can do this. There are hostages that you can capture and torture. And there is a lot of stuff that you can do, but you feel that you have been outplayed by the player rather than by the game. And I like that. You mentioned that you had played it months ago. How does it hold up? Do you still like it? I think you can, but you only take everything that you jumped over that is of the same color of what you land on. Okay. Yeah, I remember corruption being a thing when I played Sobek, but it felt always there was someone who was getting too much of it, and so you didn't have to worry about it. So the fact that this is just two player means that obviously if I'm not if I, if you are not the one with the most corruption, I am, and that makes it sound more interesting. I haven't played the two player version though. We will try. Yeah, that one I've seen, and I really like it. It's a refreshing take on the art in the original Sobek. Well, nothing new, but we finally got back into Escape, the Curse of the Temple, and man, I hadn't realized. Sorry? OER. I hadn't realized how much of an acquired skill it is. So the rule book says 600 is a good challenge, 1200 points is a very difficult game. Our record is 2100 and something. So we tried and we got whooped. So we're now we lowered our score to 1800, which is still quite good, considering that the designer says try 1200 if you want to suffer, basically. And we did beat it after some tries, but yeah, it's different than when we were playing it a year and a half before. I'm still impressed about such a simple concept, basically roll Yahtzee style, but not even Yahtzee style, roll as many times as you want, just try to be fast about it, can be to me so involving. And I think unless someone just hates real-time games, which I understand why someone could do it, could not like them. I have no difficulty understanding how someone can think they're not their thing. But once you do not mind the real time, I can see anyone not at least enjoying it. I know it's very stressful for a lot of people, but I really, really enjoy it. It's stressful too. Yep, there. Yeah, I also consider sleeving them somehow and then putting stickers on the sleeves that ex to explain it. Because even for us, there are a couple that are kind of similar, either in art or in effect. And so when one of those comes out, is tricky. It's tricky, and we have played it literally hundreds of times, so it's tough, and there is so much to explain already without having to explain all of those as well. But yeah, I still really, really like it. Bears has the only flaw with Bears is that I only want to play it with four. And so there is a little more leeway in how many I like playing Escape with. I have never tried Project Elite. Have you seen it? Project Elite is, I think, it's a Simon game, at least in its latest incarnation. I don't know if before it was something else. But it's basically a real-time dice rolling game in which you are fighting aliens. It's a cooperative game in which aliens are swarming you and you have to move and shoot them. And from my understanding is it's quite involved. In Escape, the Curse of the Temple, you're doing a lot of things, but it's basically roll this combination of dice or roll this combination of dice to do this and that. While in Project Elite, apparently there are different monsters with different stats, different speeds. You need different weapons. You go pick up the weapon. So it's like a real tactic strategy game. I mean, not the Descent level of involvement, but kind of that kind of style, but you do it in real time. So I would like to try it. I'm not sure it would be a game that it might cross into the line of too stressful for me, but and I have a soft side for an Indiana Jones setting, but yeah, XCOM has the opposite of Escape and even of Project Elite, which is there is not a standard thing that you're doing. Basically, every player in the real-time part is doing completely different things. Then the resolution is kind of the same. I have been playing a lot of XCOM 2, and by a lot, I mean I played 2 days in a row. Yeah. I hadn't played a video game in 2 years, so for me, it was a lot. But for those who have played XCOM, the board game doesn't have the tactical element like the video game, but it has a lot of the flavor. Each player is playing a different station. One is dealing with UFOs, one is dealing with aliens, one is dealing with money, and the last one is researching, basically building the tech tree. And yeah, that's different though, because there everyone is doing something really different. It's also up. Integrated, which I don't mind, but it makes for a very different experience. More immersive because there is music and there are events and there is sudden threats that come out of the app. But I do miss that game. That's another one that you only want to play with three or four, though. Fair enough. That's a very good. I think it's supposed to be a difficult game to win in general, which is good for me in co-ops. But yeah, it's not on you, it's on the game. Absolutely. Okay. Do you want to start us off? Good. But they are in hand. Okay, which you had mentioned, yeah. This one I don't know anything about. What is Excavation Earth? So the images look amazing, obviously. The screen-printed meeples, or I don't know if they're stickers or screen-printed. They are very, very nice. The pieces are awesome. The game board gives me a very, very vague idea what it is. For those at home, a map of the world with strange symbols highlighted and connections between places, but okay. Yeah, that's true of us. I mean, it could be great. I see a lot of spaces for things that look like they could be great if all of this stuff comes together, though, because there are tracks on your player board. And again, I come at this knowing absolutely nothing about the game, but there are tracks on your player board in different colors. There are different colors of meeples that match different spaces on this big board. There are connections. There are points that you can collect during the game, but there seem to be also scoring condition at the end of the game. you can collect tokens that seem to be some of them single use, some of them to stay and give you powers. So there is a lot going on. And so the risk with this kind of Kickstarter could be that doesn't come together, that you have a lot of mechanisms, but at the And David Turci is one of the designers, which is usually a guarantee of good stuff. And I haven't played anything by the other designer, Gordon Kaleha. But Vengeance got really good reviews. Some people really, really like Posthuman. So the evidence points to it, at least a very playable game. It might be everyone's cup of tea, but do you? I'm gonna ask. I think Brian would like it. I think. For me, two things that come together. I finally got some hits, so to speak, on my radio signal into BGG about finding gamers nearby. I was lucky that I immediately found a group of gamers that we became very close friends with. Our friend Mike hosts every Thursday night. But from time to time, it's nice to have first, know more people and have to have other options when you want to play something that is different or when they cannot play, etc. And so, yeah, I'd written on BGG and no one answered. And all of a sudden, two BGGers wrote to me. And one of them mentioned that we have some tastes in common and things like that. But they mentioned a game that I had heard of when it went on Kickstarter and then I had never followed up anymore, which is Frostpunk, and I'm excited to play that. That was a big Kickstarter, so I never got into even considering backing it, because it's one of those that you need to be sure that it's for you. It had a lot of pieces, and but it's basically first, the setting is very interesting. It's a post-apocalyptic with snow, and I like post-apocalyptic themes in general. And second, it's supposed to be a little bit, I think it's a cooperative, but I'm not sure. And second, it seems to be almost a reuse of the idea of Crossroads cards from Dead of Winter. And while I didn't love Dead of Winter, those Crossroads cards that were basically bringing in choices determined from what was going on the board, and bringing in choices that were ethically challenging, but with an effect on the game. So it wasn't I have to role play into the thing. There were two choices, a la Battlestar Galactica. Do you want more food, or do you want more order? Do you want more moral persuasion, or do you want to kill the enemy even with brute force? Things like that, right? And so it sounds very interesting. It might prove to be a little too grim, because there are things like, do you want to enable laws that allow child labor? And that can get a little too much, but it depends on how it is implemented. And so I would really like to play that, also because I feel that those games, even when they don't work, and so you don't want to play them again, but the first time you play them, you usually have a good thematic experience, and that's also a very good way to get to know people, so... But true, but even that, I especially the first few games, I was very glad that I played it. And King's Dilemma was very dry in the resolution. From what I've seen, this has a little more. You have a certain amount of people and a certain amount of resources, so you are still making choices that are a little more dynamic. It's not just move up track one or move up track B. Things seem to be working different. If you don't have enough food, it's not going to be the same result as if you don't have enough fuel or enough people. While in King's Dilemma, having a lot of money or having a lot of people was exactly the same game effect, points for someone. There was no oh, if you don't have fuel, you take fewer actions. And if you don't have enough people, you risk penalties, right? It was, that was what threw me off. But again, no. Well, because as you know, it had a lot to like, but as we said last time, it didn't really click. So, but it will come out, right? I will have to wait for reviews on that. Also, because again, it's not a game that you want to play once and then just having tried it. If you play it, you have to play it, 15 times. So to make sure. And also right now, the friends that we have that we play games with here are not into thematic games. And that's not the game that I want to say, oh, my sister should come over and play, right? It's different, but yeah. So Frostpunk, which is by Glass Cannon Unplugged, which I don't know, but is also by Adam Kwapinski, who did Nemesis. So he is the kind of guy that I like. I am. Although it's definitely not for you, given that beside Nemesis, he also designed Terracotta Army. No, that is not the game for you. Keep your heart warm. Yeah, I absolutely agree, because leaving aside kids, which is a topic that I know very little about, I don't play with kids. But I think there are three levels on which this can be constructed or can be discussed. One is exactly what you just mentioned, which was the first one that came to my mind, which is, again, situation or interest. Some people just, they don't want to play a game that you need to get into a long explanation that is sometimes longer than what one turn of the game would take. They want something that you can throw on the game table and play, maybe play while you're having a drink, play, and then you need to step out for a moment while the others play their turn, and then you come back and play again. So there is a level of interest. So leveling, so that, yes, leads also to skill differences, but mostly because people care differently. Then there is the topic of, and I think on this first point, you said it very right, is read the room, basically. Don't bring Gaia Project to your, I don't know, exactly, or your Christmas Yankee swap or something like that, right? Much like you wouldn't bring, Taboo to your war gaming convention, right? It's read the room, and that's basically its own solution. The thing that is a little trickier is when you play with people who are interested or even into the playing hobby games, But not everything is the same, right? If someone has played Bruges or has played Castle Burgundy, two games that I adore, but that are relatively straightforward in explanation, not necessarily in playing very well, but in explanation, and you spring on them Anachrony, or you spring on them Gaia Project, and just pretend that given that they are not Monopoly, are going to be fine, and it's going to be the same, you might be in for a rough awakening. And I personally find that a little harder, because once you find someone who's into the games that we like, the temptation of going directly to the ones that we like a lot, for example, Anachrony, a game that I know it's amongst your favorite and I really, really enjoy too, it's a perfect example of a game that I think has very little flaws. It's very close to being the perfectly designed game. And I think I appreciate the design even more than I like playing the game, which is already a lot. But it would be naive to say, well, you know, once you're interested in hobby games, you can definitely play Anachrony. There is a certain level of complexity that is compounded if you have not met those elements before. For example, it does worker placement, but it's worker placement that needs to be prepared, that is not directly exclusionary because there are increasing costs and things like that. So if you have played the worker placement game, say Lords of Waterdeep, say, I don't know, even Village, which is not exactly worker placement, something like that, transitioning to Anachrony is more doable. So on that, I think I'm not particularly good. Part of it is that I don't try to evangelize, so I don't have the habit of trying to slowly build someone into games. But part of it is that I don't know how to, right? So I have been guilty before of springing on friends that had played with me, I don't know, Seven Wonders. Oh, here, the last Feld, right? Or the last Tashini. I remember bringing home to Italy, Teotihuacan, because I played Pillars of the Earth with me, and they were looking at me going like, what is this, right? It's a different level. So how do you deal with that? I know that for you, managing people with different involvement into games is often a thing. How do you do that? Which one? Oh, War Room, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's something that is at the same time, it should be obvious, but often it's not, right? Basically, is listen to the people you want to play with. For example, I tend to play in terms of genre, not in terms of individual games, almost every kind of games with one exception, which is heavy economic, particularly train related games. Like I don't play stock games and things like that. I can't tell you how many times I've had friends lightly pressuring, but still pressuring, oh, but you should really try this. And I'm like, why should we get into a game of 4 hours that I won't enjoy? And at that point, I will let you know that I'm not enjoying it because I told you in advance that I didn't want to play it. So it would be a bad experience for you with the game that you really like, a bad experience for me with the game that I don't like. And sometimes it's just listening to people, which can also lead to the opposite thing. For example, I really like Star Wars LCG, and I remember when I got into it, I had a friend, my dear friend Bryce from school, from university, who wanted to play games, and so we tried Seven Wonders. But he knew that I was playing this, that I was going to shops to play in the little local tournaments, and he was very curious. I don't think he had ever even played Magic before, and so he really wanted to play it. And I knew that it would have been a little out of his comfort zone, and also I was playing it competitively. Is I don't play many tournaments, but that's the kind of thing I got competitive in too. And so we started playing with the understanding that it would be an unmatched kind of thing. But being very clear, I hesitated at first, but then he said, well, I don't care, just teach me the game and we'll play it. And we played it, we kept playing, we would play it after school, we would meet at the library to play it or go to a cafe. And yeah, most of the times it wasn't even a match, right? I was just winning it, but he was having fun. I was having fun playing with a friend who was otherwise not into games. And so sometimes you just listen to the people and be clear with people. This leads me to the third point, though, which is there is also a certain disparity sometimes, disparity in skill in that case, or at least in success when playing with people who are fully into the hobby, right? People who meet you meet at convention, people who you meet with for game nights, people that go to the same regular events. And here I'm trying to be at the same time honest, not falsely modest, but also not be arrogant. I tend to do quite well at games. I win more often than I lose. There are a few areas in which I have big gaping hole, mostly fighting direct confrontational games. But so I know that for me, it is more often the sense of what to do when there is games that I tend to reliably win often win with big scores, right? Especially with playing at those events where, yes, everyone is interested, but the level of involvement is very different. I'm very fortunate that both with Anna and with friends, with you, with friends here, I get to play a lot. Obviously, like everyone, I feel like I don't play enough, but objectively, I play a lot of games. And obviously, especially with Euros, when you've played a lot of them, even the ones that you haven't played before, they become a little more easy to do well at. For example, again, I played Terra Mystica once. I have never played Gaia Project. Was Anna had never even played Terra Mystica, and we did very well in that game, even when playing with people who had played it before, right? And so I think that again, there it comes down to human interaction. So it's there is gonna be something. Some people are going to do well at some games, some others at others, and some are going to do less well, do worse. the same game. It's just a matter of mathematics. Sorry, not everyone is going to score the same points. And statistically, there will be some people who are more prone to do well in certain kind of games. I think that finding the right balance between not being a poor winner, winning a game doesn't show that you are better or smarter or well-equipped for something else than just the game, right? And sometimes it's also a matter of luck. But at the same time, not pretending the other thing. In those games where I don't do well, for example, fighting games, there is very little that is more annoying than when someone goes, oh yeah, the game just went a little poorly for you. No, I got trounced, right? It's not that one role. And I think that finding that balance of appreciating that we can play a game where I know going in that I will get smashed. Every time I go back to Italy, I play Magic, which I never play ever. And even when we play with the decks that I prepared 20 years ago that are poorly prepared, that I know because I've played and the others just know that are poorly prepared, my friends who play Magic win every time. Because they know how to manage card advantage, how to manage the rhythm, the pace. We are not there to pretend that it was just another lucky win, right? And again, I go to that example because for me it's unusual. But that teaches me, I think, a lot in terms of pretending that there is no skill difference at the game is wrong. I think it's also, though, we must be careful in accepting that it's just skill at the game, right? It's nothing else. If I'm good at, say, Tsolkien or Macau, two games that I play very well, I'm just good at Tsolkien and Macau. There is no other value to it. And vice versa, I'm bad at Magic. And the only thing that means is that I'm bad at Magic. There is nothing else attached, right? And I think in an environment that is concerned with winning, because games are an activity in which you can win, otherwise they wouldn't be games, right? They would be something else. The risk sometimes is to either get depressed when you play against people who are stronger than you at something, or vice versa, being uneasy with the fact of being stronger at certain games. I guess that in certain environments where things are more focused, they are more used to it. I don't think chess players are particularly uncomfortable acknowledging that someone is of a higher Hilo ranking and therefore a stronger chess player than me, and someone else is lower. In our hobby, because it's a little more mixed, is sometimes more difficult. Have you experienced any of that in playing at events or playing with game groups and things like that? Oh, rising sun. Please. I must say that in general, I'm lucky that I have rarely found sore losers in the sense of people getting angry at games. And certainly none of my friends are. Although we used to be as a group of friends in Italy before I left for the US, so 15 years ago, we used to be a very, very, people would get particularly annoyed if they lost a game, including myself and Anna, but we were like 20, so it was slightly different. I think that what causes more difficulty is that the very rare and very occasional person gets kind of angry at losing is more the, oh, you did so much better than me. It's the almost the self-beating, which is more uncomfortable because if someone gets annoyed, is a clear, well, it's their problem, right? It's a game. Why would they get annoyed at losing a game? Is more the self self-deprecation is, and you want to go, it's just a game. Don't worry. But there are games that try to address it, but I haven't found one that has a satisfying feeling. One example is a game that I really, really like. That is Nations. At the beginning of the game, it tells every player should choose the level, which is a very simple but very significant rule. Basically, your income changes, and your income is 3 by default, and you can raise it to 4 if you are a novice, or to lower it to 2 or 1 if you are a stronger player or whatever. How do you feel about those? And what do you think of those systems? To try and lose. Yep. I don't necessarily think that those kind of things save it. Because I remember when I first played Nations, and the people I was playing with, my friend Steph and their then boyfriend, suggested, oh, he's so good at this, he should play on a lower income level. Not about me, about another player at the table. And I remember thinking, No, that's a lose-lose situation. Because if they then end up winning anyhow, I will feel like super dumb. Oh, look, I'm fighting with one hand behind my back and I still beat you. And if vice versa, someone else end up winning, you're going to wonder, well, were we unfair to this guy? Were we too harsh in the penalty, right? So I'd rather lose on a playing field than win or not have that person win, even if a third person were to win, and have the idea of maybe it was just because they were limited, right? Even, for example, I never played really competitive chess. I tried when I was very young, but you get to study for that, and I wasn't going to study for a game, right? But there, it's acknowledged there are very different levels and your points and your scoring changes, but you don't play competitive chess by taking off a pawn from someone else, right? Like you do when you're learning chess. And so I feel the same is, even if I were to play, for example, people who play games online. And so I know, for example, that Lost Ruins of Arnak, but even Ticket to Ride have very lively communities online. So people who played it hundreds of times a week. So I'm sure that if I was to play Ticket to Ride, a relatively simple game about one of those people, I would have no chance at all, right? But it would be very weird if they were, well, you know, because you are so comparatively bad, I would start at minus 15 points. It would be like, no, this is horrendous, right? I'm not a child. I take a beating if I'm due one. And so even if I like nations a lot on other stuff, I will always offer that. But for myself, I have never liked that option. It's different if there are, say, things that should be balanced, but maybe one faction is a little more complicated to play, or if I have the impression that something is a little weaker. So I might say, well, you know, this faction, I'm sure it's good, so you get that because it's your first game. I'll get this that I think it's a little weaker, but vice versa, if I was sure that one was unbalanced and weaker, I would simply take it out. I wouldn't assign it to a game, to a player, to balance the fact that they're better. There are games that I don't play with non-experienced players. For me, it's very rare, but one is Twilight Struggle. Twilight Struggle is heavily influenced by knowing the cards in the deck. And the last time I played it with someone who hadn't played it before, they really wanted to learn. So I told them this and we still played it. And it was unpleasant because the way it works is there are cards that affect certain regions of the board. So if you know what you're doing, you stay away or you maneuver around it. While if you don't, is, oh, this one card that you played destroyed three turns that I took at different moments during the game doing things in that region, right? And so if you don't know, if it's happening to both, it's like, oh, surprise. But if one player knows it, it's not a pleasant experience. So that's, for example, a game that I will strongly object to playing with someone who doesn't know it. If they really want to learn it because I know it's a game that I have always wanted to play, etc., and they still want to play it, I will play it. But at this point, I almost feel like I am showing them the game rather than playing the game. Because it's based on position, yeah, it's based on how you're doing in that game, not how you are theoretically good or bad as a player, right? Is if you have, but even if it weren't, if you are, it could be that one game the particularly experienced player did not as well, and they are taking the advantage. I know that there is something in a game that I didn't particularly like, Power Grid. In Power Grid, there is something about this wanting to be the second player because the second player gets some advantage over the first or something like that. But so that becomes an integral part of the game. And actually, the skill might be to stay second until you're ready to jump ahead, right? but that's not on you because, oh, you, Frank, you are good, therefore we penalize you. You, Julia, you are not good, so therefore we give you stuff. That's not as nice as, oh, Frank is doing very well, James is not doing as well, therefore James in this specific game where he's already not doing well, not because theoretically James cannot do well, but because this game is going poorly for James, James will get extra points. And to me, that's or extra something. That's completely different to me. Yeah. Okay. I have no additional thought on this, I must say. I think I have exhausted my Yes, and the idea is that they read it from comic books, they know that they can do it. And I think you struck upon how, and obviously we are jumping already into things, but we will backtrack in a moment, but how it's by Virginio Gigli, right? And Gabriele Ausiello, but Virginio Gigli is in that group of Italian designers with whom both Luciani has worked with Gigli. I don't think Tascini has ever worked directly with Gigli, but they have certainly worked with the same people, right? So I was thinking about Tiletum and First Rat are both quite dry Euros in their playing. And spoiler alert, I like both of them quite a bit. We already Tiletum, I like First Rat quite a bit. But they couldn't be more different in how you can have team in a dry Euro, right? It's not going to be a very thematic experience. You will not go home feeling like you have played a role-playing game, no matter what. But this makes it even more of an indictment of the designer that instead choose, what can I put that is very drab and very dry and very dull as the theme of my game, right? I don't get it, because this proves that you can have a very solid Euro with a very cute team. So I in very short terms, and that also shows how very linear this game is you have a team of rats. You start with two and you can and should gain more throughout the game. On your turn, you can either move one rat from one to two, five spaces and get whatever you land on a track of basically increasing rewards. Or you can move any number of your rats of one to three spaces, but, and this is the great catch of the game, when you land, when the ones that you move must land on the same color, and there are four or five colors on the track. That's it. That's the rules of the game. Obviously, depending on where you land, you're either collecting resources that you're then spending for endgame bonuses, which are usually first come, you get more points, but everyone can score everything. Or you get some benefits that can be either increasing the amount of stuff that you get from different spaces, or you bring out a new rat, or you get special equipments, or you buy special equipments, or you get cheese that is a way to buy stuff or get points. So that's the general gist of it. Just move one or many rats. Having more rats gives you more options, but often it's hard to move more than one. So that's it for the game. So very simple rule. It's among the simplest Euros that I've played in a while in terms of rule movement. You just activate. You don't have to worry about worker placement. If someone is already there, you pay one cheese, which is significant, but almost never game-breaking. But what you do with it is quite impressive. So what was your general feeling of the game? What do you think the main hook was in this one, beside the theme? Absolutely. And this, I didn't explain it. It's basically when you're in certain spots, you can buy ongoing powers, basically, like special powers for the game. But as you were saying, you can either buy them, which is paying cheese, which again, you can convert to points. So you're kind of paying a little bit of points for very significant powers, or you can steal it, which means you send your rat at the beginning of the track. That on one end is a negative because higher spots on the track have straight up better rewards. But at the same time, because whenever a rat gets to the top of the track, is locked in, if you want to have a lot of rats out and being able to use them, you want to send them back at the beginning. So it's a matter of timing of when do I push them back down? And yeah, it's definitely jumping to comparison. There is nothing else. Not only that, but the designers usually are designers that I like a lot. That don't do anything particularly weird with euros. Like Lorenzo, for example, is theirs, which has some very clever idea, but is quite straightforward. Use dice that are value as workers to put in. Yes, there is an important twist. Everyone has the same numbers. You're not rolling your own, but it's not crazy, right? And is you have different cards that are basically different tracks, and everyone can have their own. So a lot of new things, but they have a DNA shared with other games. While this, to me at least, is completely new. And that's definitely something, right? It's completely new and completely different without having to sit through the hour and a half Feudum explanation, right? It's through a straightforward game that will come easy and click easily for people who are used to Euro games, and yet it feels different. It's quick, is straightforward. It has a lot of strategies that you can pursue because you can go with radically different objectives. It has a lot of interaction because you want to be first on certain things. I do agree that it's quite unique. Theme, we have mentioned a little bit the theme in general. I was thinking of how well it is implemented. I think it's, again, not going out of its way to make it thematic, right? It's like you find stuff just because you find them. There is no the succession of stuff on the board is just there. So I'm not going to pretend that it is not only not a very thematic game, but it's not even a bitoku or in an anachrony where the theme is crucial to the understanding of the game. This you could not lean into the theme. It would be a great mistake, I think, but the game would work anyhow, right? And there are certain things where it's completely arbitrary. You have different parts of your spaceships that you are building, and you want five cans of something and two cans of something else because they could have been one and nothing would have changed thematically. But I think it makes sense. It helps you remember that orange is one thing and purple is another, and there are ways to skip certain stops. And as you were saying, the mechanism of moving back to the beginning of the track is called stealing, so you remember that you can do it when you are in front of the things. How do you feel that the components work for both gameplay and theme? Yeah, I agree. They are nice to look at, but they are very confusing. One of the two should have been wood. Obviously, you also wanted it to be screen printed and with metal Original embossed coins and things like that. But even, well, the rats needed to be screen printed and be funny. They are just me. They are. Mm-hmm. You heard it here first. Nathan finds rats adorable. When you hear from animal control. Well, German families. No. No, and I think it's not even a matter of rules. I think I could teach the rules to my family, to friends who don't play games, but A, it wouldn't be fun for them, and B, it's specifically because the rules are relatively open, there is very little that you are prevented from doing. Doing it efficiently is tough. So yeah, the simple fact that something, the rule-wise, could be memorized easily doesn't make it a family game. I agree 100% with that. I would never ever play this with family. I mean, obviously, if your family is into hobby board games, that doesn't make it a family game. It makes your family a gaming family. But yeah, and I'm not surprised, because even it wasn't even considered for the Spiel des Jahres, because it's not in that category at all. It is probably a little lighter than other games by those designers, but not by a mile. It's just a little more streamlined. But again, it's like saying that Macau is a family game because the rules are not that hard to explain. I don't think that makes it a... I think maybe that's part of it. There are very little special rules. There are like six comic books that give you individual powers, and they're very straightforward. But then by that category, most classic Euros would be family games, and I don't think that's the case at all. Special. I haven't played with those yet. They look really nice. They are little cardboard token that you physically insert on top of your rat to give them a personality, basically. Pace and Dark. Well, the game ends either when you were bringing your fourth rat, but people should be able to see it coming because it means you have three rats in already, or when someone puts their eighth cube down, and cubes are basically scoring. They get their eighth scoring condition or whatever. But in that case, everyone gets another round. But I do agree that, well, the pace, I think it's excellent, because you either move one rat or you move multiple rats, and the spaces you land on are not super complicated, and you are limited by the colors you can do, so it's not like you have infinite choices. The arc, I agree that you do a little bit of the same, but by the time you're placing cubes, you start placing more cubes simply because you are in that part of the game. So when you start repeating what you're doing, you see the end. It's not the end yet, but you at least see it. And also, there are a few things that change. You gain special powers. You increase something that I didn't talk about, the the bulbs, the light bulbs. There is a track that basically makes it so that light bulbs per se don't give you anything. But if your light bulb track is ahead of your rat, equal or ahead of your rat, that rat gains more stuff. And so towards the end of the game, you're getting more stuff. So it's a snowball effect. So you're still doing the same thing, getting X amount of resources and spending them for X amount of points. That doesn't change. There are no special completions or new objectives that come out or anything like that. But you see the snowballing effect of, I'm now scoring more and more, both because my rats are further ahead on the track and because of that. So, and because you have more backpacks, which are basically a way to get more of something when you get it. And because you have the can that you mentioned before that allow you to double production, or because you have special comic books that give you some kind of bonuses. So I do like the arc, and I'm realizing that more and more, the more reviews we do, the more games we discuss, pace for me is a lot, because there is a lot that I can forgive, even if not that there was much to forgive in first strat, but in general, there is a lot that I can forgive if the pace keeps going, if I feel involved often. It's not that games with a slower pace cannot be good. I do like some games that have a slower pace, but vice versa, any flaw that is there, if the pace is low, is going to be a problematic flaw. With a fast-paced game, even the fact that the arc doesn't really excite you at the end, it's not like you, well, maybe bringing in the fourth rat is exciting, but simply having built, oh, I built a third cube of this kind, you only build two, might make me win the game, but doesn't excite me, but the pace stays very, very quick. I don't know, I haven't played enough to think in terms of strategy. Replayability seems to be there. Is one of those replayabilities that are not, oh, there are 200 different cards, but simply the order of things you do will change, and therefore the thing will change. But even with the basic board, I feel that there are different strategies. I saw it in the handful of times we played it. Well, no, we played it one time, two players. I looked at it a little bit more, but we went for radically different things and pivoted towards different things towards middle of the game, because you can speed up the production of new rats, you can get straight up points, you can get cheese, you can get materials, you can get special powers to try and win later. So there is a lot that you can do. I think it was very solid in a very small package. It's also a very cheap game. I didn't get it at Essen, but it was like 30 euros or something like that, which is impressive. So had you played anything else by Gabriele Ausiello? Oh, this is only his second game. The other one was Politica, so I definitely hadn't played anything. And Gigli, though, has done a few that I know both of us like. Grand Austria Hotel, Lorenzo il Magnifico, Coimbra, Golem, which I know you like, I haven't played. He also did Alma Mater, that neither of us enjoyed. Egizia, that I didn't like. So is one of those names where I am always interested, but it's not for me a guarantee that things will be good, right? Also because, for example, I adore Lorenzo il Magnifico. I was going in there. And Terramara, but there are a lot of people involved in both of those. Lorenzo Magnifico is Luciani, and Terramara is with the entire Akitoka collective. So going in, well, before hearing from you, I was interested but cautious. I must say that after your glowing review the first time you played it, I was very well disposed towards it. But that can also mean great expectation, great disappointment, right? And it really clicked. It clicked for both me and Anna immediately. One round in, we were like, oh, this is very good. And I still think that's the case. the cap. Agreed. But again, it's not like you're given one at random, right? So even the fact that, for example, there is one that is for specific pieces of the spaceship, while another one is for complete spaceships, which will almost always be lower, always, it can only be equal or lower. But that means that you can speed up and get the good one. You're renouncing something else. So I don't think that they pretend to be the same, right? Because it's not like you get some at the beginning of the game randomly. It's not that a few come out every round. So, oh, this round when I was planning to get one, I got the crappy ones, right? Is they're there. Do you want to speed up to the one that will determine your strategy? Go ahead. You're leaving behind your own rats, basically. You are not bringing them up because you are speeding for that. And you're stealing it probably and going back. So you have moved one rat all the way up just to get that, while someone else might not get that, but be more consistent with their growth. So I mean, and the same was with the comic books. Anna got a couple of comic books early on that I felt were better than my choices, but I was doing something else while she was getting that. And so I think it evens out. I think I won by a few points. She was far ahead on points on the board, but I had only bottle caps, the end game scoring. And I think that inched me faster by a few. I'm checking. I thought I was done. But later she even got limited by the amounts. Yeah, 85 to 82. She got limited by the amount of cubes. Cubes are scoring markers. When you place 8, the game end is triggered. You can place up to 10. She could have placed an 11th, which would clearly have won her the game because they are worth 4 points or more, but she didn't have any. But we knew that was a rule. So again, you can go for scoring, and if you get a lot of resource-generating powers, you will have a lot of ways to score that, but you need to be flexible on other things as well. I'm conflicted about it because on the one hand, it seems like it could be, right? More options would be good of what you can do with your rats. At the same time, though, the board, even on the randomized side, it's meant to be a certain balance between you cannot always get to the colors that you want, but there are only so many that you cannot be cut out. So to add something would need a significant reimagining of that, or adding something that doesn't fit in that smoothness of the game. I think for me, this will be a slightly quicker, slightly simpler to teach Euro that I will keep like that. On par with, for example, what, even if it's a very different game, on what Castle of Burgundy is to me. Castle of Burgundy has a lot of different little rules, but I know there are a lot of expansion, but I never felt the need for it because Castle of Burgundy occupies a space of being a slightly less involved Euro. I think I need those. I'm not a big fan of the classic Euros, the Princes of Florence, the older Nizia, with the exception of the auction ones. But I do understand that feeling of sometimes I don't need the next incarnation of Tolkien or Anachrony or Aquasphere. Sometimes I just want a Euro that I can play reliably in less than an hour, that I can explain, that if I explain to you before, you are probably going to remember it. And I fear an expansion would mess with that. I think that oh, like you want to build something or something else. Yeah, that could work. And obviously more of the special powers or more of the things. Almost a queenie, basically, even if it's not queen games. Yeah. I liked it. I like it a lot. That's been probably my favorite surprise of this year, because even if I wanted it at Essen, of this last year, let's say, but I didn't know much. Like Heat, I noticed it at Essen and I knew a lot about it immediately. Some of the other games I got, I really wanted. I had wanted them for a long time. Others I bought after trying it. First Rat, I knew very little. I knew the designers. I knew you liked it. I knew the kind of game it was, but I had no idea of how it worked. I had no idea of how complex it would have been, or not too complex in this case. It was a great success in my book. Yeah. I'm Jackie, and as usual with this thing, with podcasts and all of that, consider liking, sharing, reviewing, all of those kind of things that I'm sure you know help a lot. And until next time, I'm Jackie. Thank you, Nathan. Bye.